Well, great to see you guys. What a substantial audience. This is awesome. Well done for coming out on Sunday night. Thank you, Pastor Sean and John, for having me here. Really, it's an honor to come and address you lot. And it's good to see some familiar faces, some from the GME conference in Melbourne not that long ago, February, Michael and a few others, Hugh somewhere in the audience. Yep, over there. And of course, good friends, John Lockwood, Pastor Sean, we met years ago doing a conference somewhere. Yeah, amazing. And Ray Moran, there's a few others here that I know. So it's good to see some friendly faces. I really want to stress something, ladies and gents, before I start. I'm absolutely just an ordinary dude. Absolutely nothing special. I don't have any titles. Well, not in this country. And the Americans, they slap funny titles on you when you go over there. I lecture there a lot. But I really want you to know that I'm nothing special. I'm not any kind of VIP. I honestly don't want you to treat me any different. I'm just an ordinary guy in the marketplace doing my assignment. And I'm here for three lectures or three messages, I think. And so over that period, we'll expand on this concept of assignment and how God applies the favor and then the multiplication that comes with it. Okay, so that's all I am, and I'm just no different to anyone else in here. If you hear me talking about millions and hundreds of millions, please don't be intimidated by the figures or the numbers. Just receive it where you're at. We all start somewhere, and we don't all have to save the whole planet. Okay, so we all have our own gifting and our own capacities that God put into our DNA, and that's where we operate, and that's where we walk from and how we grow. You know all that. You've heard it all before, so that's good. Okay, so I'm the founder and CEO of Paladin Corporation, just a little bit of background. We're now a $300 million group. We started with nothing. I'm going to give you a testimony shortly about in 2001 with nothing. And we started off deliberately to fund our church, and we built the company for that purpose. And then the Lord grew it. We're about a $300 million group now. But we should be a billion-dollar group by the end of 2016. We're heading for two big contracts. One of them is over €1 billion, and there's no other company in the world that can do that contract. We have unique software that can do it. We may not get the contract because we're small, but we'll still have to do all the work. So I'm building that deliberately, not because I want to be some heavyweight billion-dollar dude, purely for influence. Okay, it's really important that we have influence in the marketplace. So if you can picture, I heard you say kings, John. Where's he gone? I don't know, you're allowed to say kings here. Oh, okay, will I get into trouble? All right. So what I'm saying is we have to influence the secular kings, the secular world, all right, not only the Christians. And in order to do that, if you got on your bio, the billion-dollar, here's Dave Hodgson coming to talk from the billion-dollar Paladin Group, that attracts people. And that's why I want it. And also, we need the funds to change our social infrastructure and so on in this nation, which I'll get to shortly. So that's just some of the stuff that I'm going to talk about. My covering, I come from City Edge Church in Caloundra. I've been there for 14 years now, no, 15 years actually now. And I head up the marketplace ministry of that church, which is called Kingdom Investors, that John alluded to earlier. And that started off as an internal church business group, which has spread now around the country and around the world. My pastor there is Senior Pastor Paul Bartolo and his team, and that's the covering that I come under wherever I'm talking anywhere around the world. In terms of Kingdom Investors, I will expand on that shortly, but suffice to say that we avoided Melbourne and we avoided Sydney deliberately with KI. KI is Kingdom Investors. It's all over the rest of the country, but we deliberately avoided these two big cities because we figured it was already covered, mainly fairly covered by guys like John and Peter Kentley and, you know, Pastor Sean and Alan and so on, Alan Curry and so on. And that is the case. So we kept away because of that. We also kept away because we just couldn't fit any more in. It's like I start at 4 a.m. and never finish before midnight, and that's 7 days. That's 140 hours a week, literally. I never, ever teach on balance because I wouldn't have a clue how that works. But at the end of the day, we just can't fit anything in. It's just out of control, and that's a fact. So that was the second reason. And third reason is I'm honestly not a willing speaker. I don't like public speaking. I don't like being the center of attention. As you'll hear from my testimony shortly, my background is SAS and another special forces unit. And the last thing you do in the SAS is poke your head above the radar and look around, you know. So I honestly don't like to be the center of attention. I deliberately didn't want Kingdom Investors to grow. I never promoted it. And I thought, well, we don't have to go to Melbourne because these dudes are doing it. But you know what? One day we were coming back from KI in Perth on the plane, and I felt the Lord telling me we needed to bring a particular message to Melbourne and Sydney, the concept of the sheep nation, which I'll expand on shortly. But the Lord showed me we had to do that. I'm bleating and whinging. I'm always bleating and whinging to God. I don't know why it has to be me. I wanted to go jet skiing and so on. And he's saying, we need you to take this message to the bigger cities. You're not going to do it. You're not going to change a nation if you don't go to the capital, you know, to the big commercial centres. And so I was sitting with Wes Hone, who some of you would have met by now on the plane. And I said, hey, Wes, this is what I feel like the Lord's told me. And he said, yep, that's exactly what I think as well. And another good friend of ours, John Dingermanser, was sitting across the way. And we spoke to him and he said, yep, and I'll help you. So that was it. We then came down to the GME conference a few months ago, and about 6 or 7 pastors invited us to come and talk at their churches, and Pastor Sean is one of them. So hence we're now here. Like it, whether we liked it or not. So here we are. Now, also I want to say, guys, I have absolutely no agenda. I pay my own way. I don't want any offerings, all that sort of stuff. I've got no books to sell you or CDs or anything. I really honestly want you to know that. I'm not telling you that to big note us or me. I'm just telling you that because I absolutely want you to relax and know that I'm only here to try and put into the kings, okay, the Christian men and women in business. Literally. So I'm a business person like you guys. I know that you get pillaged every week by the church and by every other group and youth group and other group that needs your cash. By the end of the month, you've got no cash flow. Okay, I know, I've been there. So at the end of the day, I'm not here to do that. I would rather put in, and I really want you to relax and get rid of any skepticism that here's another dude on the circuit trying to make a quid. That's not the case. I'll make a quid in the marketplace. All right? So there we have that. So I'm talking 3 times at this group over the rest of this year. And one of them is actually clashing, we spoke about earlier, because we've got to start KI in Beirut, believe it or not, in Lebanon, which is a big audience, over 1,000 in that group, I believe. So that's hopefully we can reschedule. But during those 3 sessions, I really want to sow this vision into the group so that we understand what would the Lord have us do in the marketplace. Despite which church you go to, despite which denomination you go to, none of that matters if God wants us all collectively to do something in the marketplace. We can unite under a cause. You know, there's over 35,000 registered Christian denominations in the world, none of who agree with each other, and so we will never unite under doctrine, so we shouldn't even try. We should unite under a cause, shouldn't we? Yeah. So if the Lord wants a sheep nation in the earth and he wants us, the Christian business people, to achieve this, then we should unite and do it. And, you know, I can tell you that in every KI audience that we lecture to, and some of them are really big, you can ask for a hand, a show of hands. Catholics, there they are. Brethren, there they are. Chandelier swinging Pentecostals, there they are. Everyone's there. Literally, there's never an argument. It's always, what's next, Lord? What can we do next? How can we grow our business? How can we create wealth to do your will? So this is what I want to try and teach. I want to show you, firstly, through biblical interpretation and teaching, a lot of which you may not have heard before because it's not something that's going to be taught in church. You know, because obviously the church focuses primarily on the gospel of salvation to a large extent, and that's awesome. I love my church, love our pastors and everything else, and that's great. But we've got to extend that on into the gospel of the kingdom. We've actually got to execute what we taught in church. Church is first base. Getting saved, that's the victory from God. Now we've got to occupy. It's the occupation where we change the nation. Okay, it's in occupying, ousting Babylon, getting rid of the enemy and replacing it with the kingdom of God. So that's how it works. So I want to demonstrate this to you from biblical teaching that comes straight from the front line of kingdom business. But I also want to demonstrate it through testimony. Ladies and gents, it's the testimony that's missing. It's the kings, the real kings, and I don't mean that in any kind of condescending way. I'm just talking about those that have really climbed up the economics mountain are too busy to come and teach everybody else. And so the testimony is missing. And that's a terrible, terrible tragedy. So this is why I'm so focused on doing this sort of stuff. And I'm not some real king. It's just that I know that we'll head up to be a multi-billion dollar business, and we must use that out. We must teach out of testimony. In Matthew 24, when Jesus, the disciples are asking Jesus about the end of the world, end times, when are they coming? I hear it all the time, you know, end times are here, the Israelis have all found a homeland, tsunamis and war, it's all happening, earthquakes, so it's now the end, and the gospel has been preached to every corner of the earth, and therefore it's the end. Well, it hasn't. It says the gospel of the kingdom must be preached to every corner of the earth, and it hasn't. And then it says it must be preached out of testimony. A testimony must be shown. And a testimony is empirical data of what's happened. It's not some theory that happened 2,000 years ago in the book of Acts. Okay, it's what's happened now. Testimony, what did you do in your business? How did we get rid of the sex slavery? How did we get rid of the trafficking, the unemployment, all these things? That's the testimony. How did we turn off the tap that creates these refugees, etc.? So that testimony is missing, hasn't happened yet. There's bits of it, and there's some excellent work being done, but the actual genuine rising up in the marketplace and taking over, that's what we have to teach out of. We've got to show the kings that it's doable. It's not impossible. In fact, it's so easy to take this country. We can do it, all right? So I want to teach out of all of the above over these next three lessons. I really encourage you to please attend all of them if you can. Come and listen to teacher, and you need a note if you're not here, okay? And also, I want to teach others so I can go jet skiing. You can do the heavy lifting for a change. So some of the topics, we're going to talk about the sheep nation, obviously. We're going to be talking about working in multiples. I think maybe Wes might have covered some of these things. So we want to get off this 3% from ANZ stuff, you know, and really start to work in multiples, make sure we're making a lot of money so we can fund the kingdom. I want to teach you how to make money from nothing. You don't have to have money to make money. It's not all about money. Keep in mind, we're talking about influence and funding social infrastructure and so on. And I also want to talk to you about the enemy, how to recognize and overcome the enemy. And I've learned that in the physical, real world, fighting, infiltrating the enemy and killing the enemy physically in war, live war, from the inside for many years. Okay, not only in the SAS, and I'll talk to you about that shortly, but it's so, so important that we know the enemy, that our enemy. We've got this concept that Jesus won the battle and now the enemy is defeated and therefore we can all just relax. Well, it says in the New Testament the enemy's raging around like a hungry lion, you know, and we better look out for that enemy. And if you just look out the window, there's just as much divorce and domestic violence and, you know, poverty and stuff. The enemy is still around, man. And we have to understand why is that and how to head him off at the pass, how to defeat this enemy. And again, it's not that hard. It's doable. Everyone in the room can do it. All right, so I just want to say, ladies and gents, it's not a prosperity message, okay? This is all strategic. It's for a reason. We need to bring the kingdom of God into the earth, and that means doing things God's way. So some of you who are at my table at the GME, you'll hear we've a bit of repetition here, but it's just good revision, and it's a message that we need to keep on about. So we're going to have to address sex slavery. I've just got a little list here. Unemployment, poverty, the refugee crisis around the world, the domestic violence, substance abuse, suicide, unfunded liabilities that are going to destroy this country if we don't fix them. There's no way out of it. We have to address them. If there's any politicians in the room, we need to talk about it. You know, my whole focus in my company is on a lot of that stuff. And of course, the latest buzzword, radicalization, there's so much that we need to fix. And that's why we need the funding. And that's why it's not a prosperity message, not the old prosperity message that came through the church. Okay? We need to find the actual solutions. And that's why we need to work in multiples so that we can raise that money to do these things. If we were to graphically draw the world economy at the moment, it would be a pyramid. Okay, we would find that almost all of the fruit from almost all of the people on earth goes up that pyramid to just a few. So almost all the fruit of all of your labor, including the Christians, goes up the pyramid to just a few families and a few despotic rulers in the world. We get enough to live off. Our education system dumbs us down to a thing where everything that's too good to be true probably is. Okay. No one said that when Jesus bust out with the feeding the 5,000 from a little handful of loaves and then gave 1,200% back to the kid. That wasn't too good to be true. And they opened the Red Sea and the Jordan. That wasn't too good to be true. We've got to work in those places. We've got to use the right-hand side of our brain, which the Greek left-hand side has now dominated. We'll get, if I can get to that, knowing our enemy, I want to teach you on all these things that we've learned over the years and how we've got to get this right-hand side functioning again. All right, there's a lot in this, so hopefully we can get through it all. Okay, so, what would God's economy look like in a graphic? It's the three concentric circles of where there are no pointy bits, there's no going to the top. It's all this business of provision, overflow, and multiplication. It's how God works. And if there's time, we'll go into that as well. So what I'm going to do tonight is give you a testimony. And out of the testimony, I just want to bring through a lot of points because this is all true story. It might sound a bit far-fetched to some of you. But those of you who come out of Africa, you know, my vintage, I'm 60, nearly 60 in a few months. So who come out of that vintage won't be all that surprising. You all, you know, it would just be normal stuff to you. But to, you know, dinkum Aussies, it's a bit strange because it's kind of far-fetched. Africa, life's pretty cheap. But out of that, the reason I do this is to give you, to put this whole vision in context, needs to know where we come from and why. Why is it me that's teaching this stuff when I don't even want to be public speaking and so on? So, and then you can relate it to yourself and you can see that you can actually, it applies to everyone. So that's why I said in the beginning, I'm nothing special. I really want you to absorb that and know that it applies to everybody. Okay, and as I'm going through this, concentrate on gifting. You've all heard about gifting in church. We're all good at stuff. I'm not talking about the fivefold ministries and spiritual gifts and so on. I'm talking about that which is in your DNA, which God deliberately put there into your deoxyribonucleic acid. Okay, your DNA is where God puts stuff that you are good at. And he did that deliberately because he wants you to do stuff that you are good at. Okay, so when we get onto the concept of assignment, we're going to be talking about gifting. I need to let you know that now because throughout my testimony, I want to pick on points when I say, here's my gifting. I'm an entrepreneur. I'm just a natural entrepreneur. I can spot a deal a mile away and I have the natural fortitude to carry it out and make sure it's done. Okay, there's different types of entrepreneurs. Some just pillage and rape. But my whole drive is to spot a deal, do it, and make it work. And I love doing that. I also have a gift for teaching, and I don't like teaching because it means public speaking. So I'm not scared of public speaking. I just have no memory. If you don't sleep, you don't remember stuff. So I'm always trying to remember what I've said here and there and so on. So I'm going to bring those out as we go through this testimony. Some of you have heard this testimony before, Ray, at the opening of some of your things, so apologize. But there's different points in it. Okay, we do actually have other messages. Okay, so I grew up in Africa, and I was mainly up in Zambia, which was then called Northern Rhodesia, and I was really a white black guy. Okay, I had no white friends. I didn't even speak English. I spoke Bemba. That was my home language, really, or my first language. I spoke English to my parents, but only because I had to, because they were POMs and they wouldn't learn any other language. And it was in the colonial 1950s, all right? And so I lived in the bush. I learnt the bush. I learned how to track and trap and make fire and make string, and I knew everything about the bush that a little kid could learn. I didn't have to go home to eat. I could just stay in the bush and be happy and live happily ever after. But all of a sudden, when I was 5 years old, the independence movements were sweeping south through Kenya and down through Tanzania and so on and into northern Rhodesia, which became Zambia. So my parents, there was a bit of unrest and so on. They got frightened and thought, this little kid, better send him to boarding school and get him out of the strife. So they stuck me on a train and sent me to school right in the southern tip of Africa in the Cape Province. And it took 10 days to get there across four countries on these old steam trains that stopped at every big tree. And I was just turning five, so I was 4 years old. See you later, unescorted, come back in June. Literally, that's what happened, okay? So I went off to boarding school, stuck on a train. I saw a picture some time ago. I was standing next to my suitcase, was nearly as big as me, and I had a teddy bear under one arm, and off to boarding school. Okay, so I end up getting to boarding school in South Africa. First thing I do as a five-year-old is go and find the black kids because I couldn't speak proper English. These guys were speaking Afrikaans. This is King Williamstown. Even though it's in the Cape, they were still Dutchmen there. And I had to go and find the black kids. I got my brains beaten out for talking to black kids. I never understood apartheid. And then I went to go and talk to the white kids. I thought it's safer. I won't get punched out so much. And they didn't speak English. So I was kind of dumbfounded, 5 years old, left in the wilderness. I didn't know what I'd done wrong and why I was there. I didn't understand freedom and Uhuru and everything else that was going on. So I grew up with that kind of adversity. I had to learn to fight on those trains. Man, you had to learn to fight. You lived all on your own. Bullying was just, you know, that was the flavor. So I learned to look after myself, learn about the birds and the bees very early, learned how to drink and smoke and all about girls and things like that at a real early age. It was just, you just had to. And it was good fun anyway, so it wasn't such a big deal. Anyway, I went through school. Eventually, my parents moved out of Zambia down to what was then Rhodesia. It's now Zimbabwe, but in those days, it was Rhodesia. They declared independence from England unilaterally. In other words, they just seceded on their own. And of course, the British blockaded the ports we were using and imposed international sanctions. And every country on our borders declared war on us, except South Africa to our south. So we were at war with all of the bordering nations when I went to school. So I was pulled out of school in South Africa. My parents moved to Rhodesia. And I now went to boarding school in Rhodesia. And my parents lived on a farm. And I went back there. So to me, very first thing, go and find the black kids. And there was no apartheid in Rhodesia. I was allowed to talk to them, had to learn the new language, which was Shona. And again, I became a white black kid, basically, on the farm. I learned all the bush there, different trees to learn and so on. But it was just my natural heritage. That's what I wanted to do. So I went through school, and this war grew and grew and grew while I was at school. The war lasted nearly 15 years. When I left school, my girlfriend was pregnant. I was very young. My girlfriend's pregnant. We wanted to get married. Her parents said no, and so did mine. So I had to go into the army and do my national service, and she got sent to a maternity home. And we decided we'd get married as soon as we were 18. In those days, you actually had to do what your parents told you to do. So I had to go to the army, and the first thing I thought, well, how am I going to pay for the maternity for my girlfriend and so on, and how am I going to stay alive? Here's me, just 16, just turning 17, joining the army. In the Rhodesian army, you're not allowed to get shot until you're 18. So I had a whole year of just training, and I'm thinking, man, how am I going to fund this? You see, this is this entrepreneurial gift coming out. Joining the army, huge adversity. My girlfriend's pregnant, I want to marry her. Dad said no. Now we've got to go and fight a war. Enemy's been fighting for 5 years. That's as long as World War II. Very experienced enemy. I'm a schoolboy. How are we going to do this, and how are we going to make a quid out of it at the same time? Okay, so that's why I joined the SAS. They paid more. It was literally why I went to join the SAS. So I did all their selections and stuff and got in. And of course, as I said, weren't allowed to get shot. So I did just course after course. And when you do a course in the SAS, they are mad. They're off their face. They just drill it into you and you never forget it. You just get overtrained and overtrained. So by the time I eventually got deployed a year later, I was very well trained and knew a lot of stuff. Obviously no experience, but it didn't take long to get that as well. So we did all the stuff that you read about and so on. During the 1970s, the Rhodesian SAS was regarded as the finest anti-terrorist unit in the whole world because we were the most experienced. So you can log on to the SAS Association and read all this stuff. I'm not big-noting me. I've got no agenda here. I'm just putting it into a context of how the SAS operated in those days. And it was only small. When I joined, there were only 40 of us operational soldiers. When I left, there was about 200, 260, I think. So here's a little thing off the website. This is a book written by the written about the Rhodesian SAS. In her foreword of her book, The Elite, The Story of the Rhodesian SAS, Barbara Cole wrote. So Barb Cole was the wife of one of the officers in the SAS. Rhodesian SAS, one of the most formidable fighting forces in the world, operated almost exclusively across the border during the long, bitter Bush War, undertaking deep penetration missions against insurgents being harboured inside neighbouring Mozambique and Zambia. We went into all the other countries as well, so not only those two. Fought against the magic and madness of a changing Africa against insuperable odds. We're outnumbered about 7-1 in terms of army and the whole military, if you like. Against two terrorist armies who were aided and abetted by the armies of their host nations and backed by Russia and China, two of the world's superpowers, the role of the SAS was unique. Some of their exploits may seem far-fetched, even impossible, but then truth is often stranger than fiction. It's a history of high adventure and daring, of courage and humanism, be it driving through the streets of a neighbouring city, walking bold as brass down the streets of another, knocking out trains, bridges and vital installations, or swooping out of the morning skies, then with the ability to hit hard and fast, attacking and taking their leave, the devastation complete, the mission accomplished. Nowhere was out of reach or safe from SAS attack, and no target was too big. Okay, so that we did all the stuff that you read about the Aussie SAS do. I've trained the Aussie SAS up in Tully and tracking and bushcraft and stuff like that years ago, and I'm part of the SAS Association here as well. So I'm giving you this background because when we come on to dealing with the enemy, this is the credentials that I learned, the Lord showed me to bring this military history into the spiritual world. And it's very, very similar. And it's all about what small groups, remnant groups can actually achieve. Okay, and it's unbelievable what you can achieve if you just believe and go for it. Okay, so as we go through these next three lectures, I just want to bring out bits and pieces, little war stories here and there, because it helps you remember and know that it can be physically done. Eventually in the SAS, I'm leaving out a lot of stuff because I'm trying to really condense quite a bit into three lectures. But I was in the SAS for 4 years, and I was a really aggressive little brat. Because of my, you know, being through all the boarding school and so on. And I wasn't a very nice little kid. As you can see, I'm only a little dude, but I had to be aggressive. I had to learn how to defend myself and so on. And so I had too many fights for my own good. And also, I was carrying all the rejection of years and years of being sent away by my parents and so on. So it was well hidden, unless I had a few beers, and then all of a sudden it would all come out and so on. And I rose up through the ranks very quickly. I was the youngest guy they ever had in the unit, and I rose up the ranks quickly because I was very determined. You know, when you suffer from rejection, you tend to try and prove yourself. So that was my drive all the time. And eventually the squadron sergeant major called me in one day and he said, if you ever have one more fight in this unit, I'm going to send you to the School of Infantry for a year. And that means, you know, taking a frontline SAS soldier to go and train recruits for a year. There's nothing worse. You know, you'd rather be shot. And so I thought, well, I better leave. I'm probably the only guy on the planet who ever got kicked out of the SAS for being too aggressive. But I ended up joining. I was offered a job in a unit called the Salu Scouts. And that was another special forces unit operating in Rhodesia. And you can log on and read about these guys on the internet. So keep in mind, in the SAS, we operated behind enemy lines a lot. In the Salu Scouts, we actually infiltrated their ranks. So we trained to become terrorists. We learned everything about them, just like Daniel did at the University of the Chaldeans. And we had to come out 10 times better than they were, otherwise we got taken out. We had to infiltrate them and kill them from the inside, literally. And you can read all about this, you know, can't even exaggerate anymore because of the internet. So these are all true stories. So here's a little excerpt from the Salu Scouts Association website. And again, this is important as we go forward with these lectures because it gives you background. And when we start to learn about the enemy, this is what can happen. I'm not glorifying war. I just want to explain stuff, how it works. Okay, the Salu Scouts' training and operational doctrine inculcated audacity and an incredible intimate knowledge of the enemy. At various times, for example, white Salu Scouts posed as the prisoners of black Salu Scouts, terrorists. Okay, so the Salu Scouts were disguised as terrorists. We dressed up and looked just like our enemy. And we would be, I'm a white guy, black guys with their AK stuck in my back are going to escort me naked into an enemy camp. Okay. White prisoners were highly prized. Escorted into terrorist strongholds where white prisoners were highly prized. At the appropriate moment, the Salu Scouts turned their weapons on the terrorists, wreaking havoc from within. The classic example of audacity and intimate knowledge of the enemy was the Salu Scouts raid on the large Zandla terrorist camp at Nyadzonya Pungwi in August 1976. Using unimogs and ferrets painted in Frelimo camouflage. So Frelimo was the Portuguese freedom movement that we also fought against. So we disguised ourselves as them on this occasion, okay, in a neighbouring country. 84 Salu Scouts penetrated Mozambique and drove directly into a large terrorist camp. Thousands of terrorists were in the camp preparing morning formations. This is a true story, 84 against thousands. You can log on and read this. Thousands of terrorists were in the camp preparing for morning formations when the Salu Scouts opened up with 20mm cannons, 50mm and all the various hardware. Estimates of the number of terrorists killed ran as high as 1,000, all for 5 slightly wounded Salu Scouts. As the Scouts withdrew back to Rhodesia, they blew up the Pungi River Bridge, frustrating pursuit behind them. Okay, so that's the sort of operations that we did in the Salu Scouts. And again, I'm not glorifying war. I'm just telling you what can be done if we will engage and we will do what the Lord wants us to do. Okay, after that, I was then the Scouts for 4 years and I took over the tracking and bushcraft academy there, a bush camp, and taught all the rest of the army and the armed forces, including the South African army and so on, all about bushcraft and tracking and poisons, how to poison people without a trace and all that sort of stuff. So that was my formal military career. And then for the next 2 years, I became a mercenary, or we called them irregulars. In parts of our country were overrun by the enemy. We were invited back in, ex-special forces, to go and hunt down particular terrorists, and we were paid per head, per kill. and per AK. So $1,000 a kill, $500 for AK, $1,000 for a landmine, $5,000 for a capture. I was earning $360 a month as a colour sergeant after 8 years in the army. And that was my day job. Now, all of a sudden, getting paid $1,000 a head to go and hunt down and kill terrorists, that to me was like, you know, El Dorado is paradise. So, yep, I went off to go and do that for 2 years. And out of that, remember the entrepreneur thing? It's a gift using it in the wrong context, but it's still that same gift. It's in us. It's in our DNA. If you're an entrepreneur, if you're a singer, you can make CDs and sell your CDs, but you can't sell your gift. It's there. Okay, it's always there. Kerry Packer, awesome gift of entrepreneurship, used it for the wrong camp, but nevertheless, what a concentration of gifting. Okay, same deal, that was my gift. So I funded a substantial fishing company. I was very successful at what I was doing, and I funded a really big commercial fishing enterprise on Lake Kariba, big 60-foot trawlers, three of them, and also two mines. So, and I did all of that out of being becoming a bounty hunter. Incidentally, that was one of the real struggles I had when I became a Christian, was to understand forgiveness from the Lord for shooting people to fund my company. So for the previous 8 years, I'm fighting for king and country. That's all good. You know, we honour our VC winners here in this country and so on and so on. But for those next 2 years, I wasn't fighting for king and country. I knew we were going to lose the war. We were losing the war politically. We never lost it in battle. We lost it because of sanctions and so on. It was just closing in on us. And so I thought, I better make as much money out of this war as I can and make sure we set up for when it finishes. And so, yep, I was shooting people for money. Yes, they were armed and they were shooting back. But nevertheless, they were fighting for what they believed they were freedom fighters. And I believed, I'm going to fund my fishing company. Show me the next comrade to shoot. You know, the Russian, they called each other comrade and so on. So when I became a Christian, I found it really hard to understand forgiveness. I used to go to church and so on, and I hear the pastor saying, oh, you know, God can forgive the drug addict and the alcoholic. I think, man, that's all social stuff in this country. Everyone does that. You know, and he can forgive the liar and the thief, and I'm always swatting my kids' hands for stealing stuff and so on. He's never going to forgive me. But eventually, I heard pastor once talking about Paul and how he used to hunt down and kill Christians. And I went home and I read all about Paul. I thought, man alive, this dude hunted Christians and killed them and held their jacket while they stoned Stephen and so on and so on. And I never did that. He got to write half the New Testament. He was so forgiven. You know, and I never hunted Christians. I never asked, but I presume it never, you know, wasn't an issue, but they were armed and shooting back. That wasn't as bad as Paul. And only then did I start to accept forgiveness for the stuff that I'd done. And then my whole world changed. The rejection disappeared. The competitive spirit disappeared. Yeah, literally. And that was about 4 years after getting saved. So I know what goes on in the heads of men. Sometimes we don't accept what God's offering, which is not a good deal. Okay, so as I said, I had two mines and so on. When independence came and Rhodesia became Zimbabwe, I sold the fishing company because I thought, okay, that's an asset we can sell. We'll carry on mining, and if I have to leave the country because of my past, at least I'll take some produce from the mine. Mugabe promised there wouldn't be a witch hunt. The SAS packed up as a unit, left with its families, kids, wives, a whole lot, as one big armoured column, and joined the South African army and turned its weapons facing north. The Sulu Scouts were disbanded completely. There were two factions, Robert Mugabe's faction, Joshua Nkomo's faction. Robert Mugabe's was the had the more people, so one man, one vote. They won. They slaughtered 33,000 of Nkomo's people, the Matabeles, and rendered them impotent and took over the nation, and the rest of it is history. They've pillaged the place and wrecked it. And I don't care who's running a country, black, white, brindle, it doesn't bother me. I'm not racist in any way. I just don't want corruption. It's not God's way. It's Babylon. And Babylon reigns there. Okay, so that's what happened. They promised there wouldn't be a witch hunt. So we worked the mines for 2 years. My house got rampaged and sacked and burgled regularly because they were looking for stuff to make sure I wasn't working for the South Africans and so on. And one day somebody blew up a squadron of British Hawk jets at one of Robert Mugabe's airbase. 12 jets were blown up. This was about 2 years after independence. And they were having a big court case to see who it was. At that time, they also formed a mineral marketing board, and they said, you will sell your minerals to us small miners. This is how much we're going to pay you. These are the new wages, and deliberately put us out of business overnight. So I came to Australia in 1982 with a camera full of sapphires to try and, that's what we're mining, to try and bypass the Mineral Marketing Board, look for an export market. And I came here for 3 months on holiday with 300 Zim dollars. That's all you could take out of the country. And while I was here, they acquitted whoever they'd accused of blowing up those planes and accused me. I was the last guy left in the country with the skills to blow up those planes. Because remember I said I did all that training in the SAS? Well, I did most of the demolitions work, blowing up all the bridges and stuff. I was on the DEMS team because of all of that training. So I was very capable of blowing up a squadron of Hawk jets at some very badly looked after airbase. But I didn't do it. Okay, so I was here. They're going around my parents' farm. They're strangling my mother. When's he coming back? And so on. My mother eventually managed to phone me and said, you can't come back. And so I never, ever went back. So here I am stranded in Australia. Try to get in. They said, nah, you go out like everyone else and emigrate in. No one had a heart for refugees in those days. You out. Okay, so I had a one-way ticket back to Zimbabwe, and I was here with my wife, not the girl I made pregnant. I forgot to tell you that after a year she had the baby, and I'm busy paying maintenance and getting shot at and ducking and weaving and trying to make money to fund the maternity case and so on so we can get married shortly, and I'm waiting for my first leave to get married, and then she got married. So we were kept incommunicado in the army. I wasn't allowed to talk to her because her parents had separated us until we were 18. And then all of a sudden, I got a telegram, actually, from my brother. He said, guess what? You don't have to pay maintenance anymore. Yeehaw, she got married and the kid's been adopted. And I was angry. You know, you can imagine, I was already a rejected kid. And I was just I just turned 18. I was miles into northern Mozambique. And I came back weighing about as much as a stick because, you know, 6 weeks of being chased by Portuguese troops or Frelimo troops back into Rhodesia. And then I got this telegram. And so I was an angry young brat, which is why I got thrown out of the unit in the next instance. But bringing that back now to Australia, I was now married to my wife, Merlene, and her ticket went to South Africa because we couldn't get in the country. She went to South Africa where our two kids were, with the grandparents. Mine went back to Harare, where they were waiting for me at the airport. And I knew that airport intimately. I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to get on this plane, but I ain't getting off this plane the normal way. You know, when I get to that airport, I'm going to have to be moving around pretty fast. So fortunately for me, the plane stopped in Singapore, and I hopped off. I went and said, can I have a visa, please? You know, I'm a tourist. And they said, yep, sure, ding, you got 2 weeks. And off I went, zip, straight off. And I wasn't a Christian then. I went to a commercial diving company, and I lied my way into a diving job. I just said to them, you know what, I'm an SAS, and I know how to dive and this and that, and I'm best diver in the whole world. And the guy, operations manager, was ex-New Zealand Special Forces, and he recognized my accent, and he knew that all the Rhodesians were desperate, and they did anything they were told to do, and they weren't unionized, and he just said, come in, brother, you can have a job. So he put me in the workshop. He probably knew I wasn't a diver, but I learned to dive in the workshop. Okay, so I'm stateless. We had $300 when we came out 3 months earlier. Zim dollar was worth about sixpence. And the money's all gone, Merlin's gone, kids are gone. I'm standing in Singapore. You know, we only had one suitcase when we came out. When you go on holiday with your wife, everything in the suitcase is hers. Only mine had thongs and a toothbrush. I'm in Singapore, I'm stateless. No country to live in, no money, no job, no nothing. And I got this job to work in the workshop. So I learned to dive from the diving manuals at night. When everyone went home, I opened the books. I went, this is a helmet, right, put this on, figure it out, crack the valve, strip and assemble everything. I studied. I became a saturation diver in about 15 minutes. I just needed money urgently. About 3 months later, a guy came and worked in the workshop for 5 minutes and he went out to Japan. And I said to the operation, how come he's gone out ahead of me? He said, oh, he's a medic and we need EMTs, emergency medical technicians, on the rigs. We've got to have them in the SAT chambers. And I said, I'm a medic and the SAS, they teach you everything, you know. And he said, well, show me. So I showed him bits and pieces. We did. I worked in casualty for 3 months in Mpila Hospital, fixing gunshot wounds, everything. So he said, show me. So I did. And he said, man, why didn't you tell me? You're on the next system. So I went out, straight off to Japan, first dive, 35 days, 400 feet at the bottom of the ocean as a saturation diver. It was my first dive, literally, you know, and I was earning $1,000 a day, you know, and Merlin's in South Africa trying to get, you know, get some sort of college degree so we can get accepted into Australia. That's literally what happened. So you can be stateless, you can have nothing. You can't get less than stateless. Okay, you can't go lower than that. And that was it. And so I did that for 4 years. After a year, I managed to get Merlin and the kids out. We had enough money to bring them to Singapore. And then it took 4 years to get into Australia. Arrived in Perth just because I chose it off a postcard. A friend of mine in a diving bell got a postcard from his wife in Perth. Everyone was windsurfing. I thought, oh, that looks good. Sent my wife a telegram. Why don't we stop in Perth and we eventually get in? That'll do. Yeah, why not? So we landed in Perth and we bought a motorcycle business there. just because we like motorcycles. 40,000, the guy wanted 80 grand for this rundown old motorcycle business. We gave him 40 in cash and a Mercedes-Benz that we imported from Singapore. And that's how we bought the motorcycle business. Within 3 years, it was a multi-million dollar business in Perth. It was the biggest Ducati dealership pretty much in the country by that time. Okay, so there's that entrepreneurial gift that's naturally that I have in me. You know what? It was there that I got saved in Perth. My wife was always a Christian since Noah, and she's going to church. She wants me to come to church, so I go to church with her, and just because I loved her and stop her whinging. But I never believed a word of it. It was easy to sell bikes to the Christians. They were pretty gullible, so I was always selling them motorbikes. And sitting there, you know, it was funny in church. And I never believed anything, and I'm sure the pastors all know, visiting ministries come through, God flicks them an email and says, there, Hodgson, he's not saved, he doesn't believe what you're saying. So whenever there's an altar call, they seem to eyeball whoever's not saved. And, you know, I'm looking away, this little squeeze on my hand from my wife. I just didn't believe it. I struggled with, you know, creation and Noah and all this stuff. And we'll get onto that when we get to the mountain of education and we start knowing the enemy. But at that time, I just didn't believe this stuff. And I didn't want to be a limp-wristed Christian at all. So eventually one day, Reinhard Bonnke's coming to town. And Merlin's hounding me. And she said, look, this guy's from Africa. You know, you'll identify with him. You don't have to identify with all these chandelier swingers and so on because we're going to a Pentecostal church. So, and so she hounded me and wore me down like girls do. And eventually I said, okay, we'll go. He's coming to the entertainment center in Perth, big 6,000-seat auditorium. He's coming. And I said, all right, we'll go there. We go there in a civilian vehicle. We're not going in any of our company cars because I don't want anyone in the motorcycle fraternity to see me mixing with you Christians. We go in last. When we go in, we stand by the door. And as soon as the lights come on, we're making swastikas out of there. Escape and evasion, out the door. I don't want to be seen there. And she said, no worries. Just want you to come. So we went, we did exactly that, went in a civilian car, snuck in last, we got the last seats by the door, and then, I don't know, another 1,000 people came in and stood in all the aisles and everything afterwards, and I'm busy eyeballing which is the quickest exit. Anyway, Reinhard Bonnke gets on with his message. So he's down there, 6,000 people away, and he's just down, and there's one light in his face, he can't see anything, and he stops the whole deal, literally stopped the whole service, and he points straight up the aisle to where I'm sitting. And he's a German dude. He's got this thick German accent. Up there, he says, there's a young executive in the motor industry. So, and this is in the early 80s. So I was young once. And he says, there's a young executive in the motor industry. He says, you're here under duress tonight. He says, the Lord has knocked on your door many times, and tonight could be the last time. So come now. Come. And, you know, I said to Merlin, geez, do you think he's talking about me? Yep. How dumb can you get? And she says, what do you think, Matt? So I thought, this is a setup. You've got some of your disciples are down there from your church. So he's saying, come, quickly. So I went down there. I'm supposed to be clandestine and all the lights come on. Everyone's clapping. I'd forgotten. So I went down there because I thought it was a setup. There was no one there from our church. Okay, it was all of his disciples from Africa. And that's how I got saved. And I thought, oof, better pay attention from now on. So from then on, we moved up eventually to the Atherton Tablelands. I ran that motorcycle business as a multi-million dollar business for quite a while, and then I sold it. We moved to far north Queensland to go and do commercial farming with my brother who was up there. Didn't like the farming concept when we got there, so I started another business. It became a big business again, that same gifting, and we were selling mobile phone plans. This was before the prepaid cards came out, and I had offices in Cairns and up on the Tablelands and all over the show, and telemarketers, all the people that were phoning you up at dinner time, they were working for me, and so on. You know, it was a big deal, and I'd learned my function in the kingdom as a king, please we can say, in the kingdom, and I was funding our church, and I was on the board of our church, so I knew what was coming in, and I knew who was funding what roughly, and I knew how crucial our income was to this particular church. And I'd been there for now 10 years or so, and all of a sudden the pastor gets transferred down to Caloundra, down in southeast Queensland, to go and fix another church. This was Christian Outreach Centre. He got transferred to another branch to fix it. It was in distress. And 6 months after that, one of my sons, who's now married, is going to go and join him. So my son Storm, he's like a youth pastor, and his wife Shelley, she's a music director, good-looking young couple. What a pleasure to have them go down to Caloundra and help the pastor build a church. And one of the elders in the church came to me after 3 months after the pastor's gone. He said, hey, Dave, I had this this vision last night, and he was always accurate. He was a farmer, never said much, but he, when he spoke and he had a vision, it was always prophetic instruction. And I trusted him really well. And he came to me and said, I had this vision. There was this couple that came out from Africa. They stood with Pastor Dan and Ann, and they built a mighty church. And I said, awesome, John. That's Storm and Shell. They're going down shortly. He said, Shelly's an Aussie girl. This couple came from Africa. It's you and Merlin. And I thought, you've got to be. And he walked away. I said, John, come back. And he wandered off. I said, that's all I know. And off he went. You know, in my heart, I knew it was a prophetic instruction to go. But in my brain said, if you go, this church won't survive. Because I was funding it so substantially that I thought it wouldn't survive. Well, the church prospered and we plunged. Okay, because we weren't obedient to the Lord. This is such a key for those of you who want to engage in your assignment. God had an assignment for me. I was doing good things, not God things. I wasn't doing what the Lord had told me. I thought, nah, church work can't do without me, big heavy hero, so I stayed. The big telcos came to me one by one and they said, we're bringing out these prepaid cards, dude. You better move downstairs, rent a shop front and sell hardware, sell telephones and prepaid cards. You can't sell plans anymore. We've done this all over the world. We know what happens. You'll go broke. And I thought, I can't. I've got all these leases. God will look after me anyway. Well, God didn't look after me. He needed to get my attention because I wasn't listening. Best way to get a business person's attention is dry up the cash flow. So we lost all our customers. Month after month, it got worse and worse. We paid all the bills. It dried up and dried up. We're losing $100 a day, eventually $1,000 a day. And eventually we sold everything. Then we had to draw money off our credit cards. And eventually we had nothing left. Even, you know, if there was eBay, I would have eBayed the dog to get rid of everything, to try and get money to eat. We sold our clothes, our furniture, everything. And ultimately, we then said, well, we better do what God told us to do. You know, like it came to my senses. And my poor wife must be thinking, why don't you just listen in the first place, you know? But anyway, at that time, all our leases had now expired and we had $76,000 worth of credit card debt, all cash, so all in 20%, no job. I was in my late 40s and we had to drive down to Caloundra a few thousand kilometres. Took 3 days. The car, the last car we had left was an old boiling Land Cruiser. It was boiling every 10 Ks. That's why it took 3 days. We had one loaf of bread between all of us, five of us, and we just nibbled on the breadcrumbs all the way down to Caloundra. And when we got there, absolutely destitute, I went to the church we were supposed to go to. On the third Sunday night, I'm sitting there. I never told anybody why we'd arrived. Some of them knew me. Oh, good to see you, Dad. You know, awesome that you're here. And I'm thinking, yeah, you know. Didn't want to tell them we were broke. And so third Sunday night, Pastor Dave Mack came through the church. He's the chairman of Christian Outreach Center around the country. He didn't know me from a bar of soap. He called me out. He said, you, sir, the Lord's shown me there's finances written all over you and all over your life, and you will write six-figure checks for this church in the near future. So I'm thinking, yeah, sure. $100,000 checks. By that time, I'd got a job as a builder's laborer. I was taking home $5 an hour in my late 40s. Three kids at school, rent to pay. I was actually getting paid $15 an hour, and I had a young apprentice with me that was, his marriage was breaking up. His wife was having threesomes. He was into drugs, and it was just a mess. So he was getting $10 of that. I was taking home $5, and nothing was working. But it was confirmation for me. I looked at this, and I thought, wow. I wish I had the confirmation earlier. So there's another little key that I learned. You need confirmation for these assignments. We've got to ask for it right early up front like Gideon did, you know. So anyway, we go home now, sitting with my wife early and say, how are we going to get 100 grand together in the near future? I'm an entrepreneur. The near future is yesterday. We have to do it now. Okay, what are we going to do? So we look through the newspaper. This is Sunday night. We've engaged with the Lord. We're looking through the newspaper. Aussie Home Loans is looking to mortgage brokers. And I thought, wow, if we can get into that, we can learn how money works. We can learn how the banks work. It won't take us long. Always optimistic if you're an entrepreneur. So we had to try and get in to get an interview. And it took 2 weeks on the phone. I had to even pass a psych test on the phone just to get the interview to get it. They narrowed it down to 20. There were hundreds of applicants. They narrowed it down to 20. I finally got the interview in Brisbane from the sunny coast. Well, I had no clothes. I'd sold all my clothes. So I had to go to the pastor. Hey, Dan. And Dan's a hobbit. He's even shorter than me. Okay? We're both hobbits. And he's shorter. And he lends me his jacket, which comes up to here. Pastors, they get their jackets from the Vinnies. Dressing gown cord. It just didn't look pretty. And so I went to go for this interview, got lost on the way, got there late. There's 19 other people sitting in the room, all with their three-piece suits, girls with their eyelashes on. Everyone's looking groovy. And I come in there looking like a feral dragon from the back of, you know, Wandekla somewhere on the tablelands. And so I took one look at this lot and I just thought, oh, my Lord. And I turned and walked straight back out. And the lady said, "Excuse me, sir." And I said, "Forget it." And I walked out. And I went into the ablutions there and I was just drying my hands to leave. And you know what? I looked in the mirror in that thing and I'm ashamed of myself, you know. I'm thinking, man, I'm never going to learn anything. You know, these people are all too smart. And I realized afterwards I was frightened of their clothes. Heavy SAS soldier, frightened of the civilian's clothes. There was not even an AK in the room. And I was terrified of their clothing. Yep. And you know, I went and I'm looking in the mirror there and I felt the Lord come. I've never heard the audible voice of God, but it was almost like he was in there shouting at me with a hammer banging on my head saying, "Where have you learnt this fear? I've never taught you fear. I've taught you right from you were 4 years old, all this thing." And you know, my whole life in front of the mirror is the most astounding thing. Went in front of me just like in a flash and a blur, just in a fraction of a second, everything that happened, all those years of being bullied. And I got lost in the Belgian Congo when I was just a baby for days and nights wandering around the bush. And fortunately, I knew how to live and eat off the bush, but I came back and got beaten up by my old man for being lost, you know. And there was a war going on in the Congo at the time, you know. And all these things happened, you know. Carrying my mates to their graves. Lots of SAS guys were killed. And that year when I was training, had to do all the funeral parties. So I was carrying lots of guys to their graves, telling them during the war years, you know, parachuting into battle, everything's on fire, you're getting shot at in the air, I got blown up, my ears were blown out, both my eyes were blinded for a long time. One of them didn't come back for years, and so on. So the very first dive, that 35-day dive, I got jumped on by a giant octopus, massive octopus on that dive, and you can't come up. You can come up about 80 feet and then you're dead, okay, when you're in SAT. So all these things flashed in front of me, losing my first kid, getting adopted, and all this stuff went past. And the Lord said to me, "All that adversity is what I've taught you for your life, for this time. All these things are the threads of your life that I've woven into a mighty rope that can never be broken. Now get out there and take dominion." And that's what I was just standing there thinking, was that the Lord? You know, it must have been like Moses. Yeah. Can you imagine? It was like Moses, "If you don't circumcise your kid and get out to Egypt, I'm going to kill you." That's what he said to Mo, right? And it was kind of like that. So I was like, "Oh, all right." So I went back out there, completely changed, went back into that room, and I got the job. This is the favor. I had accepted my assignment at last, and the Lord applied the favor. And you know what? I got that job, and I went on to break their records month after month after month in Aussie Homes. Massive workforce. It's all sales and marketing. I'm not a sales guy. It's not my natural gifting, okay? But the Lord applied the favor, and we began to work in multiples because of that. And this is so important when we get into the next lectures about working in multiples and why would God want you to work in multiples. Not just because you're tithing. That doesn't cut it. That ain't why. There's a more logical reason why. It's not spiritual ease. There's reasons why. So we went on from there to understand how the banks worked, which bank would do what, who would lend me money when I've got no financials, I've got nothing, I'm broke. I wasn't bankrupt, but I'm broke. And by then I was 50. I'm earning like just $10 a day. I'm trying to figure out Aussie home loans and borrowed suits. Who's going to lend me money so I can get into a rising housing market so that I can then make money out of putting a deposit here and a deposit there and the prices rise. We're going to settle in a year's time. I want a bank that's going to do all of the above and take the new value of the land despite the fact the contract is a year old and it's back down there when the price was down there. Which bank will do all of this? I had to learn all the banks. And there are some that will do fancy things. They all got the same banking charter, but they all have their little niches. And as I learned that, I was able to get $50, which Merlin went and found a house and land package with Divine. We took $50, we put it on that one. Someone else, there was one there, we took another $50 and put it on. $50, big precious bucks to us, you know. This was our life savings, all we had left. And we put them on there. And out of the one, we made $110,000. Out of the one, we had $90,000. So out of $100, we made $200,000. We were able to write six-figure checks for the church and we were able to launch into a whole new world of finance. And I became a financial architect. Nowadays, I'm designing financial products that are patented, that are recognized worldwide, investment products and so on. $2 SAS soldier, no training in the finance world, nothing. God applied the favor, okay? He needed someone with specific gifting, entrepreneur, and specific life training, life skills, the military and all the adversity and so on, to take on Babylon at some stage. It's never been taken on. This business of this economy that I mentioned to you, this pyramid, hasn't been meaningfully taken on for 3,000 years, since the 10th century BC, since Solomon. And there's reasons why it was him, and I'll cover off on those in the next lecture. Okay, I'm pretty much out of time, eh, Sean? There's so much more to tell you guys, but we went on to build Paladin. We went on to learn how to use investors and so on. We built a $100 million business, or I should say the Lord did, within 3 years. I had two public companies, unlisted public companies. By then, we had about $100 million worth of assets, and we were funding our church. The Lord showed us we had to fund other strategic, specific ministry initiatives in this country. We aligned with them, found out that they were led by various SAS guys, so we hit it off, became personal friends, and substantially funded a lot of their stuff. And then the Lord showed me in three prophetic words that I had to go and counsel the kings. And I'm thinking, man, who's these kings? Is this Prince Harry and Prince William? How on earth am I going to get an audience with them? And then I started to learn who the kings were, the Christian men and women in the marketplace. I thought, oh no, I don't want to do public speaking. But then I thought, well, I don't want the Lord to stand me down again either. I'd learned obedience. I better do it, Lord. Okay, I'll do it. And I just said to him, I will never volunteer and I'll never promote it, but I'll never say no if I get asked to. That's why I've come from Hong Kong to do this one and go back to Hong Kong, just because I said I'd never say no, Pastor Sean asked, so I've done it. So I always do that, okay? But the point being, the Lord then grew it and grew it and grew it. So now it's completely out of control, and we have a vision that I'll talk to you about next time that'll blow you away, and you'll see how it's actually the momentum in this country is massive now. It's not just an isolated thing. We really will change this country. So I'm out of time. If you want to interrogate me afterwards, I'll be over there. So God bless you, and thank you for listening. Can I read a prayer, Sean?
Yes, you can.
Okay. I just want you guys to have a little listen to this prayer, please, because I want us to go out of our security for next time. So this is a prayer written by Sir Francis Drake. Some of you old fossils my age and above are going to all know about Francis Drake. All the young studs probably don't, but he was a great British mariner from the sailing ship days, okay, when they only just found out the world was round. Disturb us, O Lord, when we are too pleased with ourselves, when our dreams have become true because we've dreamed too little, when we arrive safely because we sailed too close to the shore. Disturb us, O Lord, when with the abundance of things we possess, we have lost our thirst for the waters of life. And having fallen in love with life, we have ceased to dream of eternity. In our efforts to build a new earth, we have allowed our vision of the new heaven to dim. Disturb us, O Lord, to dare more boldly, to venture on wider seas, where storms will show your mastery, where losing sight of land, we shall find the stars. We ask you to push back the horizon of our hopes and to push us into the future with strength, courage, hope, and love. Amen.